Previously on Beta.
But after the timelines realign, I'll have never even met you.
This song was put together back in the 1930s by a fella some of you may know. His name was Woody Guthrie.
It's a warm, windless night. Perfect hunting conditions for the desert scorpions.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, filmmaker Gorman Bouchard talks about Wilco's unsung hero, Jay Bennett. Jay was a world-class multi-instrumentalist who redefined the band's sound.
Everyone has their hands on the mixing board, and instead of it being automated, you are mixing the song as it's going. So it's sort of like every take would be completely different.
Also, writer Steve Almond on his debut novel, All the Secrets of the World, which was 30 years in the making.
And I have to say, it's just delicious to write about family dysfunction, having a character come in from the outside and sort of realize, oh my God, this is a house of freaks.
But first, Emily St. John Mandel. She's probably best known for her novel Station 11. It's set in the Great Lakes area before and after a pandemic. Station 11 was a finalist for a National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. It's been translated into 33 languages and was adapted into an HBO Max limited series. Emily's latest novel is called Sea of Tranquility, and it's just as powerful as Station 11. It's a beautifully written, compelling book filled with complicated characters that starts in 1912 and fast forwards to 2041. This expansive timeline gives Emily the chance to comment on our technology by considering the world without it. She also continues to build her Mandel cinematic universe by importing characters from her previous novels. My fellow British Columbian joined us from her book tour and explained why she wanted to explore time travel in Sea of Tranquility.
I've always really enjoyed time travel fiction. I love time travel film. You know, one of my very favorite movies is Rian Johnson's film, Looper. I don't know that I ever would have actually just gone for it and written a time travel novel if not for the pandemic. But I started this book in the spring of 2020, which in New York City was as horrifying as you might have gleaned from the New York Times reports. And there was something about the awfulness of that historical moment that just made me feel like, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. I'm just going to write whatever I want because the world's terrible. So that was the starting point for Sea of Tranquility. And once I realized that it was going to be a time travel novel, I feel like that's only fun. Or it was only fun for me if I got to traverse an enormous amount of time.
Mm. Can you talk a little bit more about why you're kind of so fascinated by time travel?
I don't know what it is. I feel like maybe we're all a little bit fascinated by time travel. You know, something I've been thinking about lately, how do you explain the popularity of sites like Ancestry.com or 23andMe? If not some kind of desire to meet our ancestors. You know, I think we always want to go and see not just how the story ends, but also how the story begins. And that's certainly something that's always preoccupied me. You know, for me, when I read about different points in time, it's hard not to try to imagine what life would have been like in those moments. And in this book, I didn't go that far back. I went back to 1912, the character Edwin, who's loosely based on one of my great-grandfathers, who's always kind of been a source of fascination for me. He left London around 1908 or so, 18 years old, under the cloud of some unspecified scandal, and then had a really strange, rocky life in Canada and the United States because he just had no skills that would translate to the real world. You know, he was the recipient of this beautiful classical education, went to very exclusive schools, probably spoke Latin and Greek, but just had no idea how to make it in the world. And there was something always kind of interesting and poignant about that to me. So I knew I wanted to revisit that time period, and then I knew I wanted to go really far into the future as well.
You mentioned Edwin. He's one of three protagonists in your book. Another one of the protagonists is a writer named Olive Llewellyn, and she lives on the second moon colony, but is doing a book tour on Earth in 2203. She's written a best-selling novel about a pandemic, which is being turned into a movie. And this storyline seems to mirror your real-life experience with your previous novel, Station 11. How close to reality is it, aside from you not living on the moon?
Yeah, aside from that, it's very close in some ways, and not at all in others. The ways in which it's close, those were the first sections of the book that I started writing. And it was a couple of months before the pandemic broke out. And I'd been having this very specific experience for a number of years of having written a novel that was very successful, Station 11. And just dealing with the ways which were mostly wonderful and which it had completely changed my life. And what I was thinking about is, you know, I feel such gratitude for this life. It feels incredible to me that I get to do this work. At the same time, people say such interesting things to me when I'm out on tour. And the word interesting is doing some heavy lifting in that sentence, by the way. So I'd wanted to write about these, frankly, quite surreal interactions that I'd had. Most interactions with readers are wonderful. It's one of the great pleasures of going out on the road. But man, that 1% is really something else. So yeah, I wanted to write about these interactions. And it seemed to me that maybe doing it in this kind of auto-fiction way, that's autobiographical fiction for any listeners who weren't familiar with the term. And what that term means is fiction that's just slightly more obviously based on the life of the writer. I think we always draw from our own lives in the fiction we write. Yeah, I wanted to write about the long tour experience. So every interaction that Olive has in this section is completely autobiographical. Those are things that people actually said to me on the road. It was kind of cathartic, I have to say, writing it down.
Yeah. Can you give us an example of one of the most surreal interactions that you've had on a book tour?
I remember I was in Texas, and a woman said to me, and just for context, my daughter was at home with my husband. A woman said to me, "You must have a very kind husband to look after your child while you do this." You know, I'm just going to go out on a limb and suggest that perhaps that's not a sentiment that male business travelers hear very often. You know, just that kind of thing where people would say things like that. And there was just this feeling of, wow, I'm literally speechless. You know, I'm out there providing for my family, but it's not always seen as such.
Yeah, that's a good example. Olive's novel is called Marion Bad, and I'm wondering, is this a reference to last year at Marion Bad, the Alain René film written by Alain Robrier?
Only in the sense that I love the word Marion Bad, and that's where I came across
okay.
it. I've tried three times to watch that film, and it just won't stick.
Yeah, I thought there might be a connection beyond just you liking the word Marion Bad, which I like too, but because I see some similarities with the characters believing they've met each other before and kind of like the dreamlike vibe of the film, yeah.
Right.
Your first three novels were crime novels. Why did you decide to pursue a different genre with your fourth novel, Station 11?
I was afraid that I would get pigeonholed as a crime writer. And it's kind of a delicate point because I love crime fiction. And I really respect it's so good. I really respect what crime writers do. They're better at plotting than anybody. Like, it's just really impressive. As a writer, though, once you get stuck in one of those marketing categories, it can be really hard to get out. And I was afraid that if I just kept on going in that genre indefinitely, that eventually I wouldn't be able to publish books in other genres. And also, I just had an interest in trying something completely different. So with Station 11, the original idea with that project was I wanted to write about a traveling Shakespearean theater company, and it was going to be set completely in the present day. It was not going to be apocalyptic at all. But I wanted to write about our technology, and I thought, well, maybe an interesting way to write about that would be to contemplate its absence. So I realized once I'd written this largely post-apocalyptic work that I had a book with a somewhat more commercial premise and that it was a very different genre. That was the book that completely changed my career.
I'm curious about how the success of Station 11 and the HBO series adaptation have affected you in terms of your writing. Did you feel more pressure when you started writing Sea of Tranquility?
I did. There was an intervening book. The real pressure I felt was The Glass Hotel, which came out 5 years after Station 11. That 5-year gap is long for me. It used to take me about 2.5 years to write a book. This is the least sympathetic problem in the world, so I never talk about it. but yeah, you know, if you write a successful book, then all of a sudden there's this invisible audience looking over your shoulder as you work on the next book. And there was a feeling of pressure there that did probably slow down the writing of The Glass Hotel to a large extent.
Yeah, very well said. Characters from your 2020 novel, The Glass Hotel, appear in Sea of Tranquility, and one writer has coined the phrase the Mandel Cinematic Universe to describe your work. What do you think of that idea?
I love that phrase, and I appreciate you saying it on the air. Right?
Oh, yeah, well, I'm just taking it from someone else, but yeah, I think it's great.
I love that idea. Sometimes I just become attached to particular characters, and that's why Miranda and Leon from Station 11 are in The Glass Hotel. Sometimes I'll be writing a book, and I'll realize that for the point in time and the place I'm writing about, there are characters I can pull in from another book, and that's why there are 3 characters from The Glass Hotel in Sea of Tranquility. What's really been fun in the last few months is thinking about the multiverse in terms of TV, because for months it felt like a huge legal problem that there were Station 11 characters in The Glass Hotel, because then those characters are the property of Paramount Television. It becomes this whole sort of IP issue. But what I've been doing with Patrick Somerville and his colleagues who worked on the Station 11 show is making that more of a feature than a bug, and it's been really fun. So the Glass Hotel TV version will star Danielle Deadwyler, who gave that stunning performance as Miranda in Station 11. Mm. Yeah, you know, of all the performances on that show, I have to say Danielle Deadwyler and Himesh Patel really stand out for me. I just think they did brilliant work there.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. They did. But besides time travel, you also explore the mind-bending idea that life is a simulation in Sea of Tranquility. Can you tell us a bit about this concept and how it developed as you were writing the book?
The problem with time travel narratives is they often fall apart under close scrutiny, because how do you travel back in time without creating a loop? So if I step into a time machine at the end of this interview and it takes me to Denver in 1910, wasn't I always going to step into a time machine and always go to Denver and then back kind of around and around? And once you set up that loop, that's pretty disastrous in terms of cause and effect and free will, which is a problem when you're trying to develop fictional characters. You know, they've got to have some control. The only way that I could make time travel work for myself as a writer was by layering on this whole other level of weirdness, and that's the simulation hypothesis, which is this theory I came across years ago, you know, some internet rabbit hole moment. And it's what it sounds like. It's the idea that maybe all of reality is a simulation. What I love about it is you can find very intelligent people who will very convincingly argue either one side or the other. So for me, that was a way to make time travel work, is by layering on this whole other idea and having a character in the year 2401 by the time machine act as kind of an avatar for the skeptical reader, or maybe even the skeptical writer, and have that character say something like, "We don't quite understand why time travel works as well as it does. The fact that it works at all might be evidence that we're living in a simulation. You know, you have to go investigate." Yeah, the simulation hypothesis was just what I needed to bring in to make the story work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. Near the end of your novel, Olive Llewellyn delivers a virtual lecture in the Hollow Space in 2203. And this is kind of like the idea of a Zoom meeting, but you've upgraded the technical side of it. And she tells her audience that she wants to consider the question of why there's been so much post-apocalyptic literature in recent times. And she's talking in 2203, but that also applies to our own time period here of 2022. Why do you think we're seeing so much apocalyptic literature in our times?
I gave all of my Station 11 lecture, which I delivered all over the United States up until I canceled the lecture on March 12th, 2020. So this is something I've thought about and talked about a lot. I come to the conclusion that Olive reaches in the book, which is it has to do, I believe, with a certain ambivalence about our technology. And to back up just a little bit, the theory that I've heard the most often is that it has to do with the anxiety we feel about the state of the world, and that a safe place to channel that anxiety is into reading apocalyptic fiction. The problem I have with that theory is, when have we ever believed that the world wasn't ending? And that is not to minimize the climate crisis or the other issues of our time in any way, just that I do believe we always think it's the end of the world, as far as I can tell. So then that raises the question, well, what has changed, you know, in the last span of 15 or so years that post-apocalyptic literature has been popular? And what's changed is our technology. We are available all the time. And there are benefits to that, but also costs. It's not great for our mental health that it's not possible to leave work, you know, that you have to set real limits that aren't always respected depending on where you work. I don't think it's always great to have all of human knowledge in a supercomputer in your pocket. Social media is sometimes great and sometimes a disaster. So there's a part of me that thinks that our interest in these works isn't really about apocalypse per se. It's more maybe some desire to live in a world that's less technological, you know, where there's a little bit more space and privacy and less tech.
Mm-hmm. Olive has this great statement or this thought that she has. She thinks, quote, as a species, we have a desire to believe that we're living at the climax of the story. It's a kind of narcissism, unquote. What do you think of Olive's belief?
Yeah, I think she's right. I think it is this kind of narcissism as a species that we want to believe we're living at the end of history, that at this particular moment, after all these millennia of false alarms, that now is finally truly the worst that it's ever been. And that does seem narcissistic to me, honestly. You know, this desire to believe we're living at the climax of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's such a great observation. That was one of many takeaways I had from the book. I just really thought that was bang on. And I figured it was your belief too, but right. You never know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I thought I'd ask. Emily St. John Mandel, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Sea of Tranquility. It's a beautifully written, thought-provoking book. And looking forward to your next book and the adaptations.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Emily St. John Mandel is the author of Sea of Tranquility. You can find out more about Emily and the Mandel Cinematic Universe at wpr.org/beta.
I tried to be very fair in the film and really showed that it wasn't Jay's fault. It wasn't Jeff's fault. They just happened to be two egos at that point, fueled by a lot of demons.
Coming up, Gorman Bouchard on his documentary, Where Are You, Jay Bennett? The film focuses on the former Wilco singer-songwriter, his musical legacy, and his infamous split with frontman Jeff Tweedy. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're a fan of the band Wilco, you probably know who Jay Bennett is. But if you're not, don't sweat it. We've got you covered. Jay was a singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, producer, and engineer. During his 7-year stint with Wilco, Jay made seismic contributions to 3 of Wilco's best albums. He's been described as the sonic architect of the band. So, does that mean that we could describe Frank Lloyd Wright as the Jay Bennett of American architects? That's a question for a different introduction. Gorman Bouchard is the director of the documentary, Where Are You, Jay Bennett? Gorman joined us to talk about the film and the life and career of Jay, both in and out of Wilco, and how he caught the attention of frontman Jeff Tweedy.
He was playing with Steve Pride, and someone had called Jeff's attention to his playing with Pride, and Jeff kind of felt that he might be right for the band, so he told the other band members, hey, let's check out this guy. And that's sort of how he came to be part of the band. And I think at that point, they didn't even realize he was anything other than the hired gun guitar player. You know, it wasn't until he sat down at a piano and started playing that they were like, whoa, wait a second, you didn't tell us you could play other instruments.
And Jay was kind of like, well, I can play pretty much anything you throw at me, you know? There's this multi-instrumentalist kind of guy. And it was a revelation to them. that, hey, this guy's got a little bit more going on than just, you know, the hired gun guitar player.
So we have this guy who can play like Don Rich from Buck Owens Band on Telecaster. He can obviously do the Pete Townsend thing with the SG. I mean, he was all about the guitar and tone. And then you had where he played Hammond, he sounded like a 63-year-old black man from Brooklyn, you know, playing a Hammond. And when he jumped on the drums, he was terrible, but in the best way possible.
So Jay became a part of Wilco, originally as a hired hand guitar player, but he also played these other instruments, as you just mentioned, piano, Hammond organ. And he was a big part of Wilco's three major albums, Being There, Summer Teeth, and Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. What did Jay contribute to Wilco's sound?
Well, I think at first with Being There, I think he contributed other instruments more than anything else. He brought in that Hammond, the piano, some truly, truly brilliant guitar playing. But by the time he got to Summer Teeth, this is where sort of Jay came onto his own. And there were overdubs, there were cellos. I mean, he discovered the Mellotron, which back in the day was, you know, the great way to sample instruments or voices, because it was actually using real audio tape inside the machine via loops. And he would be recording quite literally like overdubs all night long. I mean, look at the perfect song, which we use in the film to explore this, is Pie Holden Sweet on Summer Teeth, which has horns and strings and choruses and sounds nothing like anything else in the Wilco canon.
Jay was described as a sonic architect for the way he helped Wilco use the studio like a musical instrument. You kind of touched on it there, but can you elaborate a bit more about how he used the studio like a musical instrument?
Jay was really into doing things like everyone has their hands on the mixing board, and instead of it being automated, you are mixing the song as it's going. So it's sort of like every take would be completely different. So that's really, really using the studio as an instrument. It's sort of like playing the studio like a guitar. But he was also, like I said, really big into overdubs. I mean, I would hear from engineers that he would do tracks where there would be, you know, 20 different drum kits playing through. It's trying then to find the best one. All these guitar overdubs, all these keyboard overdubs, cellos, horns. You know, it just became this crazy collection of tracks. And it was then using the studio to find out what was best and what worked best for that song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In 2002, Sam Jones made a documentary about Wilco, I Am Trying to Break Your Heart, named after the opening song on Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. There's a famous scene in the documentary between Jay and Jeff. Can you tell us about this scene?
Yeah, you know, it's a scene where they're arguing about the intro to Heavy Metal Drummer. And Jay is trying to get his point across and trying to get Jeff to understand him.
Whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the problem is. I don't.
I just want you to understand me. Like, understand why I was
why
thinking.
Why is it so important? I don't have to understand you all the time. I feel like it's okay.
Then we cut to Jeff throwing up. Well, virtually every person that I talked to that was there said that didn't really happen in that order. And that really was Jay just being Jay. He could be a little annoying in terms of that. But I think the problem with the film is the film really made him look bad. I remember watching it at that point and going, wow, this guy's a jerk. Not realizing that, as Ken Coomer, the old drummer, says in my film, you know, every film needs a hero and a villain. And Jay was really edited to be the villain. There were also some low shots in the film, like, you know, showing Jay playing, you know, supposedly by himself in this little room, when actually he was actually playing with Ed Birch, because you could hear Ed Birch singing harmonies, and the room was packed. But none of that is shown, you know, and they never address Ken Coomer being thrown out of the band like the day before the filmmakers actually arrive. So, I mean, it's edited for dramatics. And I think, you know, some of the truth might have suffered there.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the scene of Jeff Tweedy vomiting, throwing up in the bathroom. That actually happened prior to their disagreement, right? A few days before.
As far as we know, yes.
Yeah. So a short time later, Jeff Tweedy fired Jay Bennett. And as you mentioned, Jay was portrayed in a negative light. Why do you think Sam Jones and his crew wanted to portray him in such a negative light in the film? Was it just the case of, as you mentioned, every story needs a villain, a hero and a villain?
I don't know. Sam Jones would not answer my emails.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, there's a graphic in there where it says that he did not return your emails. Yeah, you made a documentary about The Replacements in 2011, which was described as the rock version of Rashomon, the classic Akira Kurosawa film. Do you think that same thing can apply to this documentary, the Jay Bennett documentary, in terms of the truth lies in the eye of the beholder between Jay and Jeff?
Absolutely. I mean, I think any story that's this old, any story that sort of can be fueled by a little bit by, let's face it, a rock and roll star's alcohol and drugs, memories are going to get fuzzy. I tried to be very fair in the film and really showed that it wasn't Jay's fault. It wasn't Jeff's fault. They just happened to be two egos at that point, fueled by a lot of demons, and it just wasn't working anymore. And it's sort of like, even Jay's mom says, you know, that they needed to break up at that point.
I think that it was inevitable that they went their own ways.
Why?
Because of the strength of their musical talent.
Do you share that idea that they couldn't stay together because there was too much talent between the two of them?
It was a little bit of everything. They were both incredibly talented. They both definitely had egos. They both, I think, saw maybe different paths for the band. And ultimately, it was Jeff's band. So he's going to win that. And rightfully so. There were other issues, whether it be alcohol or drugs. You know, it was a little bit of everything. And personally, I wish they had stayed together because I think they could have literally become the next Lennon and McCartney or the next Jagger Richards.
Mm-hmm. How did Jay Bennett react when he was fired by Jeff Tweedy?
From everything we can tell is that he was extremely hurt. For some reason, it seemed like he didn't see it coming, but then he also says that he did. So that's another thing. There we go into the Rashomon thing. It's hearing many different sides to that story. But I mean, I would say that it really did bother him ultimately, that he wanted to do more with the band, and I think he sort of loved his place in the band.
But, you know, whatever. You know, I don't have to tell you that I was hurt. There was hurt and anger and fear. Yeah, I don't have to tell you that. Of course there was. You know, it's like asking someone, how was your divorce? It's totally cool. It's just totally cool. Yeah, we just talked and said, hey, let's get divorced. And we were like, all right, cool. There's no such thing as a happy divorce. You know, there's such a thing as a happier divorce, but, you know, the second it goes down, it's not happy.
What was the biggest challenge you faced in making this documentary?
At first, it was finding, giving Jay a voice. And it wasn't until we got some audio recordings from two different sources, old interviews with Jay, that then we finally had a voice for Jay. And that really made a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. And you also got some animation, great animation that you often synced with a lot of Jeff's comments. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was trying to bring Jay's words to life, and only having audio, you know, there's only so much you can show of, like, you know, a guy's hands on a guitar or whatever. So it was trying to take those pieces and give them life via animation.
Mm-hmm. And it was very clever and creative how you incorporated some Jeff Tweedy comments into the doc. Can you tell us about how you did that?
He had an audio version of the book that came out, and he definitely talked about Jay. So it was a fair use situation where we were able to use a few of those pieces.
Mm, yeah. Can you tell us about how Jay Bennett died his last few days?
Jay had been suffering from massive hip pain, and he needed a hip replacement surgery. A lot of it had to do with from all the jumping on the stage. However, his insurance company felt that because it was from all of his old jumping on the stage, it was a pre-existing condition, so it wasn't covered. So at this point, he was trying to raise money by selling a lot of his old vintage gear to raise money for the surgery, and he had gotten a fentanyl patch to help with the pain, and within 24 hours of putting the patch on, the patch leaked, and he died of an overdose of fentanyl.
Jay Bennett released, what, two, maybe three solo albums after he left Wilco?
The first thing he released was The Palace at 4 a.m. with Edward Birch. It actually came out on the same day that Yankee Hotel Foxtrot was released, April 22nd, 2002. And then after that, he put out three other albums: The Beloved Enemy, Bigger Than Blue, and Magnificent Defeat. And those pretty much came out within 2 years of each other. He put out another album before he died that was streaming only. He was just making so much music, he wanted to put it out, that was called Whatever Happened, I Apologized. And then there was one released after his death called Kicking at the Perfume in Air, which is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, there's this very interesting anecdote. It's one of the engineers at the Pye Holden Suites. He tells this anecdote about Jay writing the lyrics for a song on the door of the studio, and also the interesting chord progression in the chorus. Can you tell us that, share that anecdote with us?
That's actually one of my all-time favorite Jay Bennett songs. It's from The Beloved Enemy. It's called It Might Have Looked Like We Were Dancing. And one night, Jay was working in the studio, and this song just came to him, and he furiously wrote all the lyrics on the studio door and recorded the song, and it like literally put the entire thing together overnight. And then everyone else came back into the studio and it's like, what's going on? And he plays them this song, and it is just an absolutely haunting song about the end of a relationship. Absolutely stunning.
And if you were here, you would hear me lie and say I never meant for you to die. When I held you tight that one last time, and your salvation became mine. I knew that finally you would feel what I always knew was all too real. We both felt nothing.
And can you tell us about the chord progression?
The chorus supposedly has a chord progression of D, E, A, D, which pretty much is the definition of the relationship he's singing about, which is kind of funny and, you know, very much Jay.
Definitely, yeah. What is Jay Bennett's legacy?
Wow. It's what he did with Wilco, more than especially Summer Teeth and Yankee Hotel. Those albums exist because of Jay. They would be much different records if Jay was not involved. And I think Wilco would be a much different band if Jay had never been involved. So, I mean, he definitely has a lot of legacy there. But I also believe he has legacy as this one of the many musical artists that we've had, you know, in rock history that have left an impression on people, but so many people don't know who they are. And hopefully this documentary helps that a little bit. Just like, hey, there's someone out there that you should check out. And I try to do that a lot of times with my films, focusing on people that I think need more exposure.
Yeah. Gorman Bouchard, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Where Are You, Jay Bennett? It's a very powerful and very enlightening documentary.
Thank you very much for having me.
Gorman Bouchard is the co-director of the documentary Where Are You, Jay Bennett? You can find out more about Jay Bennett and Gorman's film at wpr.org/beta.
I think the social novel is trying ultimately to make sure that nobody gets flattened into a caricature. Nobody becomes purely a victim or a villain.
Coming up, writer Steve Almond joins us to talk about his debut novel, All the Secrets of the World. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Lorena was not invited back to the Stallworth residence for several weeks. She sensed Jenny was angry about the camping trip and accepted this without complaint. Perhaps it was better that she returned to the safe boundaries of her life. Still, at night, She thought of Mr. Stallworth in the desert, under the stars. She felt his hands gripping her calves. She saw the scorpions. They seemed somehow his, sprinkled across the floor of the desert like a constellation. What made them glow under UV light? It was a mystery that felt bound up in the mystery of him.
That's Steve Almond reading an excerpt from his novel, All the Secrets of the World. Steve has written 12 books of fiction and nonfiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. You may know him as the co-host of the popular advice podcast, Dear Sugars, with Cheryl Strayed. Now, with All the Secrets of the World, Steve's officially a novelist. It took him 30 years to write it, but I can assure you, it's definitely worth the wait. All the Secrets of the World is a propulsive narrative about two teenage girls whose friendship pulls their very different families into a web of secrets and lies. Steve tackles a range of subjects in the book, including astronomy, scorpion biology, tabloid journalism, and FBI interrogation techniques. And the book is a shapeshifter, morphing from one genre to another to yet another. Steve joins us now to share some of the secrets of his genre-bending work.
In trying to describe the book to people, I kept saying, well, how do I do this? Because it's written in a number of different styles, and it moves from really a story about a young woman and kind of her world expanding in ways that are terribly exciting but also very dangerous, to a police procedural, and then it moves out into the desert, and those sort of plot strands come together, but they do so in a way that has a very propulsive what's going to happen next. Every scene is throwing you forward into the next scene. And that's good. That's what a plot should do. Back to Aristotle and the Poetics, you know, there should be a chain of consequence. Not this happened and this happened and this happened, but this happened and therefore this happened. And because of that, this next thing's going to happen. That's the thrill of plot. But I'm not good at plot, Doug. That's not my thing. I'm sort of a person who's interested in people's inner lives, their thoughts and ruminations. So it was really hard to explain to people. I apparently have written a thriller, but it's a thriller that's very concerned with that ancient story of what happens when somebody who's powerless collides with the world of power. That's what's happening with Lorena and the Stallworths. It's a powerful family colliding with a family that's virtually powerless. And that's really the province of the social novel, back to Hugo and Dickens, and in the American tradition, De Passos and Steinbeck. And that's the story of kind of the larger systems of power in which the individuals are trapped. Furthermore, as you know, Doug, the book is also stuffed full of all this other stuff that had been rattling around my subconscious for 30 years. Scorpion biology, and the Reagans are in there, Nancy Reagan, and astrology and astronomy, and there's a Mormon sex cult. It's kind of nuts.
Yeah, but that's one of the most compelling aspects of it, I think. The way it mutates from one genre to another, it's just really, really fascinating. Let's talk about the opening of the story. It begins in Sacramento in 1981, and we meet these two 13-year-old girls, Lorena Sines and Jenny Stallworth. Can you tell us a bit more about them?
Lorena is fiercely intelligent. She's really smart, but she comes from a family. Her mother's undocumented. And her brother is undocumented. Her father, who's no longer in the picture, is also undocumented. In fact, they came to the United States partly so that she could be born in the United States, so that she would have a better shake in things. Her mother's from Honduras. Her father's from El Salvador. In a sense, she was a dreamer before we had that name. In fact, she's an American citizen, but the way that she moves through life is similar to a dreamer in the sense that she's constantly worried that if she does something or calls attention to herself or gets in any kind of trouble, becomes visible in any way, that her family might be deported. So she lives in this kind of constant terror, but she's also a 13-year-old young woman who is fiercely intelligent and ambitious. She's very hungry to be seen. She's very hungry to have the world recognize that. And as the book opens, she's paired with the most glamorous and beautiful classmate in her class, Jenny Stallworth, on a science project. And this brings her into the orbit of the Stallworth family, who are this wealthy white family, and into their home. And immediately, both Stallworth parents take an unnatural interest in her for different reasons. And she sort of gets sucked into the vortex of this family that's full of all these illicit urges and secrets that they're keeping from everyone. And I have to say, it's just delicious to write about family dysfunction, having a character come in from the outside and sort of realize, oh my God, this is a house of freaks. And furthermore, I find it very exciting to be here.
Yeah. How did you get into the heads of these two 13-year-old girls? Because you do like a remarkable job of capturing what, you know, they're very realistic and very authentic characters.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I was 13 years old in 1981. And I remember a lot of the events that I recount here, the dawn of the Reagan Revolution, Reagan's assassination attempt, and even moving into the homes of families that I knew had more money than me, that were more glamorous and more assured. And so that felt very familiar to me. I believe that if you peel back everybody's adult behaviors and, you know, their sort of therapized yoga breathing selves, you'll find an adolescent. We're all kind of the most alive at that age, the most hopeful and the most sort of slavish for attention and regard. And so for me, that does not live very far beneath the surface. So for me to go into the minds and hearts was really just like taking a trip back into my adolescence, which is still with me in many ways.
Jenny's father, Marcus, and Lorena bond over scorpions. Can you tell us a bit about their relationship and the role it plays in your story without revealing any spoilers?
Marcus Stallworth is a scorpiologist, and one of the first things he does is take his kids, including Lorena, out into the desert, and he turns on an ultraviolet lamp, and all of a sudden, the desert floor, that which had seemed empty, comes alive. There are literally hundreds of glow-in-the-dark. They look like the sort of toys that they used to put in cereal boxes, kind of, you know, the glowing animal of some kind, and then they start moving. And these, of course, are the scorpions who, for reasons that scientists still don't understand, fluoresce under ultraviolet light. And then Marcus picks one up, a species that's not too dangerous, and then, you know, Lorena actually wants to handle one as well. And the moment that animal comes onto her skin, there's just this incredible sense of excitement and danger that sort of stands in for the larger danger of moving into the Marcus Stallworth's world. And I think they're both curious. They both see the human world as full of deceit, and they see the animal world as a more natural and honest world. I think of Marcus Stallworth in some ways as like a scorpion. He can seem from certain angles predatory, but there's another part of him that's actually very frightened and very aware of the danger of his impulses and trying to hold them in check. He's trying to constantly retreat and scurry away from Lorena, and she continues to pursue him. So I was interested in that, and I'll just confess that as a young reporter, I was taken into the desert by a couple of scorpiologists, and they flipped on this ultraviolet lamp, and I was the one who saw 30 years ago the desert floor come alive, and I never forgot it. That's why it went into the book.
Interesting. There's also a lot of social commentary in your novel. Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan are recurring characters, and you also explored tabloid journalism, immigration, and FBI interrogation techniques. What part do these elements play in all of the secrets of the world?
Well, it is this thing we call a social novel, and in a social novel, what you're trying to do is dramatize how a bunch of characters in different positions in the culture with different amounts of power, how they collide and what happens when they collide. And in order to do that, you really have to be able to investigate the larger systems of power that people operate within. So when there's an alleged abduction and the police start investigating, I felt it was my responsibility to be able to be realistic in the way that I portrayed a police officer in making this, you know, launching his investigation. I think the social novel is trying ultimately to make sure that nobody gets flattened into a caricature. Nobody becomes purely a victim or a villain. Somebody like Lorena is certainly a victim in many cases because she doesn't have the power. But she's also complicit in certain ways in the story that unfolds, and she recognizes that. The same thing is true of somebody like Nancy Reagan. She's monstrously naive, and her actions have unintended consequences that are terrible and tragic. But she is also, as I felt and thought my way more deeply into her psyche and her heart, she's also a wife who adores her husband, and she sees him get shot, and she's desperate to keep him safe. even if that means adopting astrology as some kind of magical belief system that will keep Ronnie from getting shot again or harmed. So I really felt by the end of the book, Doug, like I wanted to understand everybody's point of view and everybody's set of incentives so that they didn't wind up, you know, you couldn't look at this and say, oh, what a terrible injustice, but that you would look at it and say, boy, how complicated human beings are and how complicated human systems of power are and how heartbreaking when people who are innocent are caught up in something and ultimately are treated as if they're guilty.
Mm-hmm. And that makes the book all the more powerful as a result. So thank you for doing that. All the Secrets of the World has been optioned to be turned into a TV series. Can you tell us about this?
Well, one of the other things that was happening when I was sending the book out to initial readers is they were saying, sometimes with a feeling of being quite shocked, like, this is like a movie. Like, I can see everything, the scorpions out in the desert. I can see the inside of the Stallworth's house. I can see this charged moment between these two characters, the teenagers in the swimming pool at night with the flickering blue light. I can see it. It's like a movie, people would say to me. And I was like, yeah, I'm as shocked as anybody. I'm not used to writing pieces that people view as cinematic. And sure enough, pretty quickly, you know, a film agent got a hold of it and read it. And before I knew it, I was in this bizarre Zoom with like 9 different people from 7 different movie companies talking about how excited they were to try to turn this into a series. And I was just delighted. So I'm super psyched. If John Feldman, who's the writer, who's worked on a Newsroom and The Wonder Years, a bunch of shows that I really love. And we talked about the book and I was like, this guy totally gets what I'm up to. Mm-hmm. And any way that I can help him make the TV show, I am here for it.
Mm. Your parents are both psychoanalysts, and when you were battling depression many years ago, your dad urged you to get into psychoanalysis. What kind of impact did psychoanalysis have on you, if you don't mind asking?
No, I guess it's all out there now. but, I mean, I'm glad to have you ask a question like that, because I think sometimes people are embarrassed to talk about having mental health issues or needing therapeutic support in some way. And it's the way I think of it, Doug, is everybody deserves therapy, but not everybody can get it because it's expensive in various different ways. And it's also frightening. But for me at that time, I didn't really understand the parts of me that felt broken or stuck in some way. And to be honest, a lot of my preoccupation had to do with, like, when am I going to be able to write a novel? Oh my God, I can't write a novel, or I can't succeed in the way I want to as an artist. And the truth is that that's a very cruel way for me to have been treating myself. I couldn't have helped it, but sometimes the central job of a good therapy is to get human beings focused on what matters, which is to esteem who you are and what you're doing. Not to say, oh, I haven't done enough, but to say, here's what I'm up to. And sometimes it feels like I'm overmatched by the things I'm trying to do, but I'm trying. And I think that's the way in which this analysis was helpful for me. It also hipped me to certain patterns that I have that helped me understand why I was overreacting to certain situations, why I was engineering certain kinds of disaster in my relationships. It didn't make me all better, but it made me better. And I'm very grateful to have spent the time and energy investigating my inner life. It's all in there looking for a way out, as Nick Hornby says. And I love that line, because that's what all the Secrets of the World is trying to say. If you're keeping secrets from the world and you're keeping secrets from yourself, something is going to end badly. There's going to be a crash. There's going to be a tragedy, because human beings, I think, are quite burdened by the parts of themselves that they cannot confess and seek comfort and company from other human beings in their lives around. And so I think of all the secrets in the world, or at least Lorena, where she begins and where she ends the book, as really a testament to somebody who figures that out and finds a way to persevere because of her tremendous intelligence, but also just her emotional and her psychological strength. I know that people have told me that the book has elements that are very dark, but I think of it ultimately as hopeful, because Lorena is able to persevere and able to help one of her students unburden themselves of a secret and feel less alone. And that, to me, feels like a real happy ending.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you on that. Steve Almond, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on all the secrets of the world. I hope we don't have to wait 30 years to read your next novel.
That makes two of us, Doug. I really hope it does not take another 30 years. It was great talking with you.
Steve Almond is the author of the novel All the Secrets of the World. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Emily St. John Mandel, Gorman Bichard, and Steve Almond. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share your favorite show with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Beat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Because I hear you've been worse than usual this morning. I didn't think that was possible, so I've been dispatched as the Steve Whisperer.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
I'm here to talk with Friedrich, or Freddy, if he prefers.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
See, this is why the tape keeps going, Doug. The little things like that. That's why we keep the tape rolling.